Succession number 27344, Reel 4.
Robert McAnulus, Reel 4. You just explained to me, obviously, the first elements in the kind of flying sequence that you'd done with elementary flying training, up until the point where you'd soloed. What are the types of things that you learn in the sequence after you've soloed an aircraft?
Well, really, it was a matter of consolidation on the very simple flying of climbing turns, level turns, steep turns, descending turns, and then you went on into instrument flying. Now, instrument flying in a Tiger Moth was really very straightforward. The pupil's cockpit had a hood that would literally pull over and tie down so that he couldn't see outside at all, but he could see everything in the cockpit. And the instructor, who was in the cockpit behind, was sitting there in the open as usual, so he could see what was going on and make sure we weren't flying into any other dangerous situation. And, of course, in instrument flying, there are six instruments that you've got to keep your eye on all the time. And it's a matter of learning to scan these instruments. And these instruments are very similar to the aircraft that are flying today, although the instruments nowadays are mainly computer-controlled. The ones we had were either gyro-controlled or controlled by air pressure. And the thing with a gyro, of course, is that it will topple if it gets into the wrong sort of situation. And once it topples, the instrument itself just goes round and round until it all settles down. Now, that can take some minutes. And if, in the meantime, you're flying in a situation where you don't know where you are, such as in cloud or fog or bad visibility, you could really be in a very dangerous situation. So it's a matter of learning to control the aircraft when you're under the hood so that you are always in charge. And, of course, in those days in the Tiger Moths, we had no radio. It was all done by signals from the airfield and the Gosport tubes from the man in the back, sometimes speaking to you kindly, sometimes shouting at you. But it was very interesting, and looking back on it, it really was one of the most important things we had to learn, was flying on instruments.
What were the six instruments that were in the cockpit?
Don't ask awkward questions. Well, the main one, I think, probably was the artificial horizon. And this was an instrument about the size of... bigger than the palm of your hand, but about that sort of size. And it had a white line across it, and in the middle it had a tiny aircraft. Now, that also was in white, or what do you call it? Fluorescent paint, so that you could see it in the dark if you had to. And when the aircraft turned, the aircraft in the centre of the... instrument turned to the same way your wing was doing, because it was fixed. But the gyro held the white line horizontal, so that as you turned like that, you could see that you were at an angle of 30 degrees, and if you pulled your nose up, the little aircraft went above the line, and if you let it drop, the little aircraft went below the line, simply because the gyro was holding it on a fixed point on the horizon. So you could get the attitude of your aircraft and whether you were climbing or descending fairly accurately. And below that was the direction. It was like a compass, except you could set it without reference to magnetic north. And that just turned. Once again, it was fixed. The gyro was fixed on a point on the horizon, and as you turned round it, your aircraft turned round the numbered ring round the outskirt. Now, that was a small band with the numbers showing as they came in from the side, and you would go round through north to west, to south to east, and the divisions in between. So those are the two that really helped you most. There was the airspeed indicator. Now, the airspeed indicator was, excuse me, it was a matter of comparing the air pressure from what's called the pitot head with the static air pressure. The pitot head was a tube which sticks out into the airstream and the air blows down it. And the faster you go, the more pressure builds up in that tube. And the static air pressure is a hole in the side, perhaps in the side of that tube or in the side of the aircraft. But it means that you're getting the static air pressure from outside without any applied pressure from your movement through the air. And the airspeed indicator just compared these two pressures and gave you a clear idea of what speed you were doing. Then there was the turn and bank indicator. Now this was a combined thing, partly gyro and partly gravity. The gyro part of it was a little needle pointing vertically, and if you went into a turn, the gyro itself stayed on the fixed point on the horizon, but the movement of the aircraft made this needle turn to the left if you were turning to the left, and to the right if you were turning to the right, and the steeper you turned, the more the needle went over, because you were pulling round through the degrees round the horizon faster. The bottom half of the instrument was a almost semicircular tube, rather like the tube that you see on a spirit level, and in the middle was a black ball. And if you were flying so that the aircraft was absolutely flying level and no movement sideways, the black ball would stay in the middle. But if you pushed the left rudder, the black ball would slide out to the side because you were making the aircraft slip sideways. And if you put your foot to the right, stepped on the right rudder, the black ball would go out to the right. So when you were in a turn, you would look at the direction indicator to decide which way you were going, north, south, east or west. Watch on the artificial horizon to make sure your nose was on the horizon as you were turning. Watch the turn and bank indicator to make sure you weren't letting your turn get too fast. And watch the black ball to make sure you weren't side-slipping. And watch your airspeed. So that you were going round these instruments all the time. Do you know, I've forgotten what the sixth instrument is. Just can't remember. But anyway, your eyes are going round those in turn, and you can't settle on one instrument and watch the, and ignore the others. It's just a matter of scanning all the time, and that was the practice that we were getting, to scan. And as I say, it lived with you for the rest of your flying career. You just had to have that ability to do it well. So instrument flying was a very important part, and I don't think any of us liked it much. It was really quite hard work, but anyway.
Was it easy to trust your instruments, would you say, at that stage?
To begin with, no. And there were many times afterwards when it was very difficult to trust your instruments, and I'll tell you about some of those later. But once you'd done it three or four or five times, and you began to get the feel for what it was like, you would trust them implicitly. Then, of course, you had to learn to handle the aircraft in all sorts of different situations, and you were learning aerobatics. And as part of the aerobatics, you had to learn what they called recovery from unusual positions. And this is where you're trying to do aerobatics and cocked it up and had to find your way back into straight and level flight as best you could. So that was another... Well, I think most of us enjoyed the aerobatics. It was good fun. But in the Tiger Moth, it was really quite hard work. And it's so surprising how hard you had to pull on the stick and the tight turn you had to have when you were trying to do a loop. You couldn't sort of go leisurely up like this because you got about halfway up the curve, then you would stall out of it. But that was another thing. And then we were still doing... approach and landings in a whole lot of different ways. learning sidestepping in for forced landings. Remember I said with forced landings you had to pick a field and try and get into it. And if you were too high, in order to lose height without gaining speed, you'd have to learn to sideslip and go down. Sideslipping, you lost height much more quickly, but you didn't gain any speed. So forced landings was practiced. Navigation. That was absolutely straightforward. This is a matter of being told to fly from Sealand to Whitchurch or somewhere else. And you were given a map and said, right, work out what you're going to do. Tell us what you're going to do and then go and do it. And it was really, I liked it. I liked navigation, and mainly because I think I like maps a lot. And I enjoyed doing it. You'd take off, circle the airfield once, turn onto the course that you wanted to go, fly for the required time on that course, and with a bit of luck, you'd be where you hoped to be. But of course, with all aerial navigation, the variables are quite considerable, not least being the wind. And if the wind is not as they forecast, then you're steering the wrong course. So you've got to be aware right from the beginning that you're steering the wrong course and make your corrections before you get so far away from your target that you're lost. And what one would usually do would be to pick a fairly prominent landmark, maybe 5 minutes flying away from the airfield, and say, well, that should be passing on my left side after 5 minutes. So at 5 minutes, you're looking around for this prominent landmark, and if it's in the right place, good, you're on course. If it's not in the right place, you've got to assess how far off course you are and what correction you make to get back onto course. You can't just sort of go around in a circle and say, oh dear, I've failed. But it's one of the things about it is that in the magnetic compass, which was down between your legs and below the instrument panel, it had a movable ring on the top with two lines across it. And what you would do is to turn the movable ring until you had the reading on the outside, which would be the degrees of course that we're going to steer. So if you're going to fly due south, you would turn the ring until 180 was opposite the arrow, which is the nose of the aircraft, and then you would clamp the ring in that position just with a little lever. Now, when you were sort of going around the airfield, the magnetic needle would be turning all the time that you were turning, but the two lines would still be pointing in the right direction. So you had to turn until the needle stopped between the two lines, and you knew then that you were on the right magnetic course. Now, the needle was, I suppose, about 3 inches long with an arrowhead at one end and just the point of the needle at the other end. So you had to make sure that when you turned onto course, the arrowhead was pointing in the direction you wanted to go. Very simple, very easy to do. But some people failed on that point, and they steered 180 degrees out. Instead of going south, they went north. But again, you see, this is why you're there, to learn. And I enjoyed navigation.
You mentioned in navigation, obviously, having to use maps and well, places or prominent locations on the ground.
Yeah.
Was there quite a relationship, obviously, in the early days when you were working with the Tiger Moth, between yourself and those prominent landmarks? Would you be always looking for a prominent landmark?
Oh, yes. When you were flying, you were always trying to make yourself aware of exactly where you were. And, of course, it was very lucky on the world, because you had the shape of the world and you were flying around that area and you knew pretty well exactly all the time, because you could see the Mersey to the north of you and the Dee to the south and the Irish Sea to the west. And in normal weather, flying above Sealand at 2,000 feet, you could see all of that quite easily. And again, rivers and lakes are very good landmarks because they don't change much. But again, once you get away from those, we used to try and use railway lines quite a lot, and they were good. Towns, generally speaking, were not a particularly good landmark, because one town can look very much like another, unless it's got in the middle of it, shall we say, the big cooling towers of a power station or something like that. Then you can say, oh, that's Didcot or that's whatever it is, you know. But generally speaking, you would look for lakes and rivers and bridges over them and that sort of thing, and you would get used to looking for these and picking them up. And of course, when the motorways came in the 1960s, they were absolutely marvellous because they could give you a very good position whenever you were belting along. But anyway, navigation was something that you had to learn and live with much more than the modern aircraft do, because the modern aircraft tend to take off and go straight up to 15 or 30,000 or whatever it is, often going through cloud and staying above cloud, and they are directed by radar and radio to whatever they're going to do, or using their own radar. But certainly when we were learning and during the early part of the war, it was navigation from, you know, bird's eye.
You mentioned your interest in maps as well. Was that a great aid to you in understanding the relative location you were in?
Possibly. I don't know. I just liked maps, and I still do, actually. I think if I had been allowed to study geography at school, I might have finished up in map printing or map production of some kind. I just liked it. What else did we used to do? Spinning. We used to do that. I see in this particular exercise I did two spins to the left and two to the right. Getting into a spin was very straightforward. I think we mentioned last time that it was a matter of flying so slowly that the one wing would stall. And it tried to make one particular wing stall, you would just put on that rudder at the juncture. So you'd be pulling your nose up with the engine off, getting slower and slower. Then you could feel the judder as the stall approached. Then you would just kick on left rudder, and as you kicked on left rudder, the aircraft would turn, and because it was turning like that, the left wing was going more slowly than the right wing, so the right wing maintained lift, and the left wing lost it, and it would drop immediately, and you'd go into a spin to the left. So you could control, when you were doing it deliberately, which way you were going to spin. Then the recovery from the spin was absolutely standard. You always learn to do this, whichever direction, however you got into it, push the stick fully forward and hold it forward and straighten up with the rudder. So if you were in a spin to the left, you would push the stick forward as far as you could and put on right rudder and hold it on, and then gradually the aircraft would come out of the spin. Sometimes it would come out within half a turn. Sometimes it might be a turn and a half. Again, with other aircraft, it might be even longer. That could be very frightening. But the Tiger Moth, generally speaking, was very forgiving of getting into a spin and getting out of it again. So that we practiced. And then also something which I enjoyed absolutely immensely, which was low flying. Because this was just like motoring at high speed. And we had designated low-flying areas where we would go and practice sort of over the sands of Dee or something like that. But it was a matter of going down to about, I suppose the instructor would prefer you to fly at about 20 feet, about house height, I suppose. And you would fly along and just learn to fly on a particular course and turn on the courses at that height, and just get used to having the ground as close as that. But it was always a thrill. It really was.
How does your relation as a pilot change, obviously, low flying from your normal, say, 2,000 foot? What's the relation like with the ground?
Oh, well, let's face it, your adrenaline is pumping. You really are, because if you're flying over ground that is not absolutely flat, like the Sands of Dee, if you're flying up a valley or something like that, you really got to be so thoroughly aware of what's going on around you. And you can have your heartbeat raised quite tremendously if you get an unexpected downdraft of wind. If you're going up a valley and you passed another valley on that side, you might find that the wind, instead of coming straight down, comes from one side in a downdraft like that, and that can give you quite a bump. And if you're already close to the ground, I can tell your heart leaps into your mouth. But at that time, low flying was very safe, really, because we weren't doing it in a dangerous geographical situation. It was just getting used to flying with the ground in close proximity. And I enjoyed it thoroughly. I think most pilots did.
You said it was done in designated areas. Was there quite a restriction, or should you have done low flying?
Always has been. The Fleet Air Arm and the RAF have always been quite controlled in where they can do the low flying, because, well, certainly as we got into the faster aircraft later on, it was very, very frightening to have somebody coming belting up a valley at 400 knots and you didn't hear the noise until they went boof overhead. And this would upset animals, of course, tremendously. And we were really very controlled, and the only time that we were not controlled and we were perhaps just a bit irresponsible was when we got to foreign parts and we were flying perhaps over a desert or something like that. And that was fun for us, but it wasn't fun for those on the ground when we passed. Right, what else did we do? Now, I think that was about the extent of it. So we were talking about the takeoff, instrument flying, navigation, low flying, aerobatics. And you were just practicing those in a sort of sequence, so you kept them all up to date. And when you came towards the end of the course, you would be given an examination by either the CO or one of the senior pilots in the training squadron. And he would fly with you and ask you to do all these various things and watch how you did them, and then make an assessment of whether you were capable of carrying on to the next stage. Some people failed, but I was particularly lucky because my examination was left until the last day of the course. Just happened that way. I think it was sickness amongst the instructors or something. Anyway, I finished up on the last day of the course having to do my final examination and then go and get packed for moving off next day. And it so happened that the weather that day was foul. It was raining heavily and blowing very strongly. And the CO came up to me and said, right, your final examination, let's go. And as we walked out to the aircraft, he said, it is really not a suitable day for a final examination. He said, we'll do what we can. So we got into the aircraft, and it was very difficult to taxi because of the gusty wind. So he said he would taxi. So we got out to the end of the runway, and he set it up, and they said, right, we'll take off and just climb to just below cloud. And that happened to be, I suppose, less than 1,000 feet. So anyway, I took off, and we got off very quickly because it was such a strong wind, and climbed up to just under the cloud, and he told me which way to go and do some turns here, some turns there. And then he said, well, we'll just hop into this little bit of cloud ahead of us and see what your instrument flying's like. So he and I were both instrument flying in this bit of cloud, and he said, right, we'll drop down now because we're still over the D estuary, and we know that there are no mountains ahead of us, so we came down out of the cloud and started to fly back to the airfield. And he said, right, we'll try a forced landing now which field are you going into? I said, that long one up there. He said, all right, oh, then. So as we headed for this long field, which we're doing an absolutely delightful one to land in, the wind was far too strong and I wasn't ever going to make it. So he said, I don't think you're going to make it. And I said, neither do I. But luckily there was another field which was suitable, closer to us. So anyway, I got down into that and then flew away from it. And we got back to landing and he said, well, to be honest, I think it's too rough for you to land. I'll land it. So he landed it. We taxied back to the station and he said, OK, you can go on. So I really was extremely lucky.
How did you feel at that stage, though? Because obviously that's first obstacle passed, isn't it?
Absolutely delighted. Because I really did want to fly, and I wanted to fly in the operational aircraft. And, of course, as you say, that was the biggest hurdle. And I had been a bit slow getting to solo, and then I had been a bit slow at other things. I don't know whether it was lack of confidence or what it was, but anyway, I got through, and I got what was called an average assessment. So then we went to, where did we go? Oh, we went to Blackpool. And we were billeted in boarding houses with landladies for a spell while we were waiting for a ship to go to Canada. And there were seven or eight of us in the particular boarding house we were in. And she was a lovely landlady, looked after us as if we were her sons. And we were there for a few days. And then we were packed on a train to go off to Greenock to join the ship to go off to Canada. And we actually joined the Queen Mary. Now, the Queen Mary didn't go by convoy. She was fast, faster than the submarines could cope with. So we joined the ship, and we were put in cabins which were probably designed for two people as a cruising liner, but which had been adapted for 16 soldiers, and we were put in perhaps six or seven or maybe eight to a cabin. And we didn't fill the ship by any means, but the ship was going over to America to pick up more soldiers anyway. So she would have been packed with American soldiers coming back. And we went into New York, which was absolutely fantastic because these were the first lights we'd seen in 3 years. And it was absolutely amazing standing on the deck of the Queen Mary going into New York and seeing all these lights. And there was quite a lot of people to greet us, but we weren't allowed ashore. So we just stood on the deck and waved to them. And then next day we went ashore and joined a train which took us from New York to Moncton, New Brunswick in Canada. I can't remember how long that took. It must have been 2 or 3 days, because the trains in America and Canada are desperately slow. They really are. I mean, when you, I don't know if you ever remember, but in the westerns, when you would see a cowboy galloping alongside a train and jumping from his horse onto the train, in this country we used to laugh at it and think how bloody unlikely it was. But that's about the speed the trains in America were doing. And very slow, very comfortable and rattling along. And of course we were all piled in, and all youngsters enjoying ourselves. And we went to this camp. It was just a holding station in Moncton, New Brunswick. And that was, I suppose, early spring. Yeah, early spring that year, 1943.